Okay, everyone. Good evening. Today is March 14th, 2016, and I just checked. This is the 157th of these classes. All of them are available on the website. You can actually get a monthly pass, and I think you can download 40 at a time. So if you want to hear earlier classes, feel free to do that. Today we're beginning a new unit. We called it Rav Avadya Yosef, the middle years. It won't take, although there's four more classes left in this semester, it won't, I don't think this will go the whole time. I think it'll go two classes, maybe three. Following that, we'll start another unit, which will take a while, not as long as Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, that went for nine classes. That's the longest we've ever done. But the one after this is going to be Rabbi Isser Zalman Meltzer. And then I'm going to follow here after that with Rabbi Yaakov Moshe Charlap, just so you get an idea of what's coming. So let us begin. In fact, before we start, I just want to pass along something that one of the listeners sent me, because it relates to classes way back, probably in the 30s or 40s of the class numbers. When we dealt with Rabbi Yaakov David Wolofsky, the Ridbaz, he sent me this from this book that just came out this year, from Rabbi Yaakov Edelstein, who's Edelstein, a well-known rabbi in Bnei Brak, and he reports the following conversation, or the following thing he heard from the late Rabbi Kreisworth. Rabbi Kreisworth, many people know him as being in Antwerp for many years, but before he was in Antwerp, he was at Skokie, Hebrew Theological College. So he was succeeded by Rabbi Chaim Zimmerman. In fact, I will have some interesting material on Rabbi Kreisworth in a future blog post. In fact, the next blog post, I think it is, that I'll have it. There's a whole story how he got the position at Skokie. But the story I'm going to tell you now is the sort of story that if anyone else told it, I think you'd be regarded as disrespectful. But hey, it's in print. It's right here. So why shouldn't I tell you? As you can see it, it says Ma'ase al Hagon HaRidbaz. And I, as always with these things, I don't know if the story is true, if it ever happened. But the fact that people tell the story itself is significant because it tells you what people were talking about. It's also not the story that would ever make its way into Art Scroll. It would be censored out of that. And the story goes as follows. It's on page 307, if you have the book. That, and it comes from Rabbi Kreisworth, although he claims that the Ridbaz told it to another rabbi, an American rabbi, a rabbi who was first in Europe, and then he's called him the Gaon Mivitebsk. I don't know who the Gaon Mivitebsk is. And the Ridbaz was explaining why it is that wherever he goes, he has troubles. And as we spoke about, he had troubles in Slutsk. I hope to write about that again later. You know, some of the machlokas he had. He had huge machlokas in Chicago. Even though he was only in New York for a little while, he had disputes. And then, of course, in the land of Israel, he had great disputes. And according to the story, the Ridbaz explained it as follows. That he happened to be in Vilna when Rabbi Bezalel Cohen. There were two great rabbis. I don't know if anyone else is having tech issues. You can write in to the tech guy. Send him a private note and he'll tell you. But sometimes wireless has a problem. So the story is as follows. There were two great brothers in Vilna, Rabbi Bezalel Cohen and Rabbi Shlomo Cohen. And if you look in the back of the big Gemaras, you have their commentaries on Shas. Shlomo Cohen is famous for greeting Herzl, and I mean, that was a big deal that he gave his support to Theodor Herzl. But Ridbaz happened to be in Vilna, quite young, when the Bezalel Cohen died, and he was known as a good darshan, a good speaker, and they asked him to give one of the hespedim, one of the talks about the person who passed away. And while he got up and he spoke, and during his speech, he said, and it says, B'lashon Sivoy, he actually commanded. He says, you know, and I tell you, you should do this. What did he tell him you should do? Now that you need to take as a rav in this community. There never was an official rabbi, but they had great rabbis, Dayanim, Rabbi David of Karlin. That's who you need to take to replace the late Dayan Betzalel HaKohen. Now, this sort of thing is not uncommon. We've had other examples. Anyone who comes with me to Bratislava, Pressburg in the summer, I'll tell you the story about how when the Chasam Sofer died and his son was quite young, the Ksav Sofer, but one of the Dayanim got at the funeral declared that the community needs to take his son as the replacement. So you have that occasionally, but it's different when an old Dayan says it. But when a young rabbi who doesn't live in Vilna, he says it. Well, as you can imagine, this created a big dispute in town, and people were very annoyed at the Ridbaz for saying this. And then the story continues that he journeyed after that to Kovno when he was with Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan, and Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan had already heard what had happened. Now, Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan is the oldest, is the senior rabbi in Eastern Europe, the greatest posseg, the most admired figure. Before there were Gedolim cards, Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan's picture was found in houses throughout Eastern Europe. He also was involved in raising money for the Land of Israel, so you can't get any bigger than Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan. We had classes on Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan, so we don't need to repeat that. So Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan says to him, I guess trying to give some advice to a young rabbi, that, he says to him, Avrech Tzair, you're a young guy. You shouldn't be getting involved in the politics of Vilna. You know, you said your piece, you could say your piece, a drasha, but when you're giving a drasha, you shouldn't get involved in the internal politics. It's not your concern. And what did the Ridbaz say back to Rabbi Tachanan? As the Ridbaz reported later on, what did he say? He says, Rabbi of Kovno, when it comes to the Babylonian Talmud, I know as much as you. And when it comes to the Jerusalem Talmud, I know more than you. And therefore, I'm entitled to express my opinion whenever I wish to. I mean, can you imagine him saying something like that? I can imagine the Ragachever saying it, but the Ridbaz also. And Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan replied, according to the Ridbaz, if you have this attitude, you're never going to have peace your entire life. Rabbi Kreisworth, who repeated this story, claimed that the Ridbaz thought that this was a curse, that the Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan was cursing him, that because of your gaiva, and you think you're so hot, that you're going to have trouble. But Rabbi Edelstein says it doesn't have to mean that at all. It can just mean that Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan, who was a great judge of character and understood how the world works, he wasn't cursing him or anything like that. He simply was telling the Ridbaz, if this is your attitude, that you, a young man, are coming and telling an older rabbi that you know more than him and you can do whatever you want, I'm telling you, you're never going to have peace the rest of your life. And the truth is, he didn't have peace, as we saw. Even though the Ridbaz repeated the story himself, you will not find a story like this. It always amazes me to find stories like this repeated by, not by people like me, but by well-known Haredi rabbis. They obviously think when they repeat stories like this that these stories are valuable, it teaches us something, but you never would find this in the art scroll. Okay, I'll get back to any questions or comments later. We'll go, as always, to about 9:55 and then take the comments and questions. Okay, so we're dealing with Ravadi Yosef, and I have a picture of him here from the middle years. We had at the very, very beginning of these classes, I gave a couple classes on Rav Avadia, which was an overview. And then after he passed, I thought it was important to have a more detailed treatment of the early years, which we had. Today will be the middle years in the next class or two. And then, of course, we'll need to do the later years. In the previous class that we dealt with Rav Avadia Yosef, we ended with his return to the land of Israel. In the summer of 1950, we spoke about all the problems he had in Egypt. So let's pick up there with Rav Avadia Yosef returning to the land of Israel, not just the land of Israel now, the state of Israel, in 1950. He obviously could not travel from Egypt to Israel. He had to first go to Italy and then on to Israel. And he had to leave Egypt, if you recall, because, in theory, he could have stayed and he would have had a decent salary. But the chief rabbi there, the so-called chief rabbi, was making his life miserable. The chief rabbi wasn't really very religious, as we spoke about, and he wasn't allowing Rav Avad Yosef to, they fired him actually, and although he still could have stayed as a, he had followers there who maybe would have supported him, and had he gone back on some of the things he said, they would have taken him back to the, be the Av Beis Din. Remember, he was brought there to be in charge of all the marriages and divorces because the chief rabbi knew nothing about Jewish law. They needed someone who could decide halacha questions. It didn't work out, and he wasn't going to stay. And for the rest of his life, he had negative feelings about not just about this chief rabbi, Chaim Nachum Effendi, but about many of the community leaders. There are certain people who stood by him, he always had a great love for, but throughout his responsa, you'll see negative comments about this so-called chief rabbi and a number of other figures. So he returns to Israel, Jerusalem, and the first thing he has to do is make money. He has a wife and children, and he wanted to return to the yeshiva, Porat Yosef. Porat Yosef in those days was the largest, I shouldn't say it's not just the largest, it was the Sephardic yeshiva, the only Sephardic yeshiva of any stature, really the only Sephardic yeshiva. Other than, I mean, you had synagogues where people would learn, but the only real yeshiva, you had the Kabbalistic yeshiva, Beit El, but in terms of standard yeshivas, it was Porat Yosef, and all the great rabbis come out of that. Today, Porat Yosef, I mentioned it in my last post, is a shadow of its former self. It's led by some fanatic who saying that religious Zionists or Amalek is just the least of the things he said. Maybe I can document in a future time all the crazy stuff he has said. And the yeshiva itself is just a pale image of what it once was. The largest of the Sephardic yeshivas and the most important is Kisei Rachamim and Bnei Brak, which has a number of branches. And Rav Avad Yosef's children's yeshivas are also more important than Porat Yosef. But Porat Yosef was the place. So Chacham Avadia asked if he could come back and be given a stipend. He'd do what Ashkenazi yeshiva students do, and that's learn Torah. And the yeshiva did support, although the Sephardic world generally was not enamored by people studying eternally and being supported by the yeshiva. They did make an exception for a limited number of people. And Chacham Avadia, who was even in those days was regarded as the leading scholar to come out of the young rabbis to come out of Porat Yosef. He assumed he'd be able to be taken in by them. However, the administration refused to allow this, say that he had left the yeshiva and was therefore not eligible for the funds. The Roshi Yeshiva did not run Porat Yosef. There was a board of lay people, and they decided the Roshi Yeshiva would have been happy to give him the money, but the board said absolutely not. He's already left the yeshiva. Now they have to spend the money on people who are still at the yeshiva rather than take someone in. Rav Avadia's teacher, Rav Ezra Atiyah, we'll come back to him again later today. He urged the administrators to give Rav Avadia money, but they didn't. And another, one of the reasons they didn't is because the yeshiva was run by the Syrian community, in particular the Aleppo community. People came from there. In fact, Rav Ezra Atiyah was himself from Aleppo, and the other Rosh Yeshiva were from, Rav Addis was from Aleppo, and the people who ran it were Syrians, and they favored the Syrian students, is from the Syrian community, over those from the Iraqi community. So where did he make money? Well, he began to give shiurim classes. He couldn't afford to have his own place. He lived with his parents, and then he found an apartment which was paid for by one of his students, one of the people who would come to hear his shiurim, paid for his apartment. It was a nothing. It was like a two-room. It was a kitchen and one room, which was a dining room and a place to sleep. It was he wasn't living that well. These years in general, the early years of the state, were not good years for Sfardim. Many were now coming in Aliyah, coming from places like Egypt and Iraq and Syria, as well as especially from North Africa. The Ashkenazim controlled all aspects of the state. The elites, both religious and secular, looked down on the Sfardim. I'll give you a good example of this. The Av Beis Din of Baghdad, the most important rabbi in Baghdad, his name was Rav Salimun Shlomo Aboudi. He arrived in Israel during this period. Here is someone who in later years, if you know the Israel Rabbinic Courts, was on the Beis Din HaGadol, the Supreme Rabbinic Court. But he arrives in Israel, and this is the greatest rabbi in all of Iraq. He's first given a job planting trees and paving roads, just like other workers. So here you have this great Torah scholar, and he's told to go out with the rest of the guys and plant trees and help pave the roads. And that was the attitude that they had towards all of these Middle Easterners coming in. And truth be told, and I'll give you a great example of this very soon, even in the religious world, they didn't think very highly. The religious world dominated by the Ashkenazim, they didn't think very highly about these Sephardic rabbis coming in. Well, Rav Avadya, already though he was young, remember he's born in 1920, so he's in his early 30s, he gets involved with a movement of Sephardim to help the children of the Olim attend religious schools. That was one of the big problems also, that they came in, they were put in these development towns and tents, all sorts of things while they get them settled, and there was a lot of pressure from the people in charge of absorption that that the children should be sent to irreligious schools, government secular schools. I mean, the families were observant. They came from certain places like Yemen with Payas. They were observant, and it made sense, obviously, to put them in religious schools, but a lot of these parents were unsophisticated, and they didn't really understand how things work, and a lot of these people involved in absorption, they saw as one of their goals. I mean, the Ashkenazim, they were Ashkenazim, but the Ashkenazi Orthodox, they knew they couldn't have any involvement with, but they figured this was a chance for social engineering to create a better state of Israel, and in doing that, they wanted to get rid of all the superstitions and the backwards practices. And they did what they could, not all of them, of course, but many of them did what they could to steer the children into the irreligious schools. And the truth is, the parents often had no idea what was going on. They didn't realize what was happening. You know, they thought this was a Jewish school. In certain places, there weren't religious schools. They sent these families, so they had no choice. With the Yemenites, you had children who were actually taken. Literally taken from the parents, and the scandal of the so-called kidnapping, and told that the parents were then told the children had died when they were away at whatever youth groups, things like that. All sorts of terrible things happened, but with most of them, it wasn't anything crazy like the Yemenites. It was simply an unsophisticated population and a group of people who were intent on bringing Western secular civilization to these backwards. I mean, the Sephardic Jews were backwards for two reasons. First of all, they were observant, which meant they're backwards. And second of all, they were Sephardic, which meant they were backwards. So two reasons that they had to bring them civilization. So Rav Avadya was involved in the effort to raise money, to reach out to the parents, to help create schools. He would go around in the classes he would give. He would speak about these things. As a means, and it wasn't just the Sephardim involved. The chief rabbinate, Rabbi Herzog, was involved. There was a great movement by the Mizrahi to try to get these kids into the B'nai Akiva and into observance schools. As far as I know, there wasn't much from the Haredim, but the religious Zionists were very involved. Among the rabbis who were already living there, mostly in Jerusalem, you had some in Tzfat and Tiberias, the Sephardic rabbis, there were really three approaches to how to deal with the state. From previous classes, we've spoken about the religious Zionist rabbis, and Rav Uziel and other, Rav Nissim, but there really were three approaches. The first was very small, and it was led by a man named Tzadka Hussein, who was Iraqi, a student of the Ben Ishchai, and he was a member of something they created called the Eda HaCharedit HaSfaradit. Basically, the Ashkenazic extremists who rejected the State of Israel created a parallel organization for the Sephardim. And you had some Sephardim who had similar views, completely anti-Zionist views, for the same reasons that the Ashkenazim had, and they formed this organization called the Eda Charedi, the Sephardim. It was always tiny, and like the Ashkenazim, they refused to recognize the government. They didn't take any money from the government, etc. The second approach, and we'll see this is where Rav Avadya Yosef is going to fall into, was the middle-of-the-road approach. not active Zionist, but very involved with the government, with the official rabbinate, taking money from them, but not active Zionist in the sense of identifying with the Zionist movement, with the symbols of the Zionist movement, etc. The third group, which I think was the largest, and I have no doubt actually was the largest, today it wouldn't be, but in those days it was that of Rav Uziel, later Rav Nissim, in which they were real religious Zionists. Rav Uziel was a member of the Mizrahi. He even traveled to Europe for Mizrahi Convention. And they saw the creation of the State of Israel as the beginning of the redemption. And that would have been the largest group. The middle group were the second largest, and the Edah Haredit of the Sfaradim, a tiny group. Look, it was a tiny group among the Ashkenazim as well, but it was a much more substantial group among the Ashkenazim. Among the Sfaradim, if you had 20 families who were involved with this, it would be, I think, maybe overstating it. So it was a really insignificant group. Now, during this period, however, this small group of Eda Haredit Sfardim thought that maybe Rav Avadya Yosef could join their movement. And that would give them a big kick because kickstart, because he was becoming popular during those years. I'll talk soon about the classes he was giving and the whole following. His following develops in the 1950s. So they tried to bring Rav Avadya in. Now, why would the Eda Haredit the Sfaradit? If you know anything about Rav Avadya's life, you know that he's far removed from the anti-Zionist of the Satmar types and everything, but yet they wanted to bring him in. Why? Well, because in these early years, in 1950, 50, 51, 52, when he comes back from Egypt and he's giving these classes, it became well known that at many times Rav Avadya Yosef would attack publicly in his lectures Ben Gurion. Why would he attack David Ben Gurion? Because of all the irreligiosity and the fact that David Ben Gurion identified with symbols of irreligiosity. I mean, David Ben Gurion's whole philosophy was about removal of the Talmud and everything like that, and going back to a biblical Judaism, a complete reversal of traditional Judaism. They say that Ben Gurion even refused to wear a yarmulke. I don't know if this is true. There is a picture of him at YU, I believe, with a yarmulke. But generally, he wore hats when he went places. Now, this was shocking. The reason that the Eda Haredit of the Sfaradim heard about this, no doubt, was because it was very shocking. In those early years, the 1950s, Ben Gurion was viewed as the savior. And people had great respect for Ben Gurion, even in the religious community, because of what he had accomplished. But here, Rav Avadya comes around, and he's attacking him. The truth is, and this is discussed by his grandson, Sassoon, in the book he writes on his grandfather, Rav Avadya, that this attack on Ben Gurion had nothing to do with extremism, per se. It was very practical that precisely because everyone, including the religious, especially the Sfaradim, they come and they idolize these Ashkenazim, who represent the reborn state of Israel, Rav Avadya was afraid that this idolizing of them would lead to an abandonment of traditional Judaism. Because that's what these figures all were advocating. And none of the religious, none of the government leaders of any significance were religious in those days. The funny thing is that some of the government leaders who were religious, none of them were top of the line leaders, like no foreign ministers or anything like that, or defense ministers. But you had second level government people in the cabinet. They didn't even wear a yarmulke, though, in those days. At least some of them didn't wear yarmulkes. I could show you pictures, and I will. My next post, Yaakov Herzog, no yarmulke. You look at people like Nebensaal and others, people who were involved in many of them from Germany. They didn't wear a yarmulke, so. I mean, that's itself is of interest. But Rav Avadya was very concerned with this idolization of the irreligious leaders, so he felt he had to take them down a couple notches. Because Rav Avadya was speaking publicly and negatively about the Ben Gurion and others, that's what led the Eda Haredit to thought that he could join them, and they offered him. And you know, when they offer you a nice salary. They must, I've never seen this anywhere recorded, but they must have been funded by the Ashkenazim. They were very close to the Ashkenazim. The Ashkenazim really created this organization. And the Ashkenazic Eda Haredit always had plenty of money. So as they, and they still do, today they have it with their hashkachas. In those days, they didn't have hashkachas, but they always had money. They had money coming in from Switzerland, from America, all over. They had money coming in from Satmar. and groups like that. So since they created it, they must have also been funding it because the Svartim had no money. And they offered Revavadya to come on the Beis Din, and that would be great. Here he is. He has no money. He's living in his parents' house. This would be a great opportunity. And he agreed. Rav Avadi Yosef says that he agreed to join their Beis Din. What does he care? Apparently, he wasn't that interested in the politics. I mean, if he has a chance to support his family, and he'll decide halacha, but he made a condition. I will join your Beis Din, but I'm going to say what I want, and I'm going to decide halacha as I see fit. Well, of course, you can't join the Eda Charidit if you're going to say what you want to decide. That's not what they want. They want a yes man. Even Moshe Sternbach, they say, when he was appointed head of Beis Din of the Eda Charidit in Jerusalem, he had to agree that his granddaughters wouldn't go to Beis Yaakov and things like that. So Chacham Avadia, I mean, he agreed to go on it if they gave him freedom. And so they thought about it a bit because, it still would be prestigious to have him. Even though he was young, they wanted a young Sephardic rabbi with a following. And then they asked him the $64,000 question. They asked him, and this information is recorded in his grandson's biography. There's a lot of biographies that came out of Rav Avadia in the last few years, but this is important because it's from the grandson and it has unpublished. It uses Rav Avadia's diary. It has the unpublished information from the family. It's very valuable. So they asked Rav Avadia, what about the elections? Because the cardinal sin for the anti-Zionists, for the Eda Charidit, is to vote in the elections. You can do all sorts of other things and still be accepted by them. But if you vote in the elections, it's as if you're giving acknowledgement to the idolatry of the state of Israel. So whatever else, I mean, you could be lenient in Jewish law, you could even read secular literature and be on the Eda Charidit Beis Din. There was one of the leaders in the Troikarta, Weisfisch, was a big follower of Nietzsche. He loved Nietzsche's writings. So that you can get away with. But one thing you can't get away with is having anything to do with the state of Israel, taking money, etc., and especially not voting in the elections. So when they asked Rav Avadia, well, okay, what about voting in the elections? He says, well, if he thinks it's important to vote in the elections, he'll take it election by election. Then he'll tell his followers to vote in the elections. And obviously, once he said that, there was no chance anymore of him being on the Beis Din. But the fact that Rav Avadia was willing to be on the Beis Din, it shows how apolitical he is. Just like he would have been willing to be on a religious Zionist Beis Din and to teach in a Zionist school as long as he could live the way he wanted to, so too he was willing to be in an anti-Zionist as long as he could lead his life. And we have many examples of this. I mean, you go to yeshivas, you have Zionists teaching in non-Zionist yeshivas, you have non-Zionists, a lot more of them, teaching in Zionist yeshivas, not such a problem. Rav Avadia Yosef, in those years, he believed that it was an obligation to support Agudas Yisrael in the election. So already you see where his politics were, his religious politics. He wasn't Mizrahi supporter, as we said. He wasn't, religious Zionist. He wasn't anti-Zionist, the Eda Charidit. He was this middle of the road Agudas Yisrael, but to the more Zionistic segment of Agudas Yisrael. We spoke a good deal about this last semester with Rabbi Yochanan Wasserman and the differences. When we deal with Rabbi Isser Zalman Meltzer, you'll see the exact opposite of Rabbi Yochanan Wasserman. You'll see the most Zionist you could be and still be a member of Aguda. But Aguda was always a large tent. And that was Rav Avadia's position to support Agudas Yisrael. He did not think that the Mizrahi movement valued Torah study enough. And the truth of the matter is, if you look in the 1950s, what type of yeshivas did the religious Zionists have? I mean, it's not like today where you have where man for man, you take yeshivas, Maale Adumim, Haaretz Yisroel, Merkaz HaRav, etc., etc. They're the equal of any of these Haredi yeshivas. The Haredi yeshivas might have more in numbers, but in terms of quality, you take the best of the religious Zionists equal the best of any of these yeshivas. But in those days, what did you have? You precisely didn't have great yeshivas. That for all the good the religious Zionists did, and they built up the land, they built up the religious school system, they did all this stuff. They didn't put their focus into yeshivas until after the 67 war. I mean, you have Keren Beyavne established, and that's really it, the only one. Merkaz HaRav in the early years was not what you would call a religious Zionist yeshiva. By the 1950s, it is a religious Zionist yeshiva, but it's almost a nothing. It's a tiny little nothing, has no significance whatsoever. It really only starts to later in the 50s to start growing a bit, and its real growth doesn't come till after 67. Getting back to Aguda, however, I can't say that Rav Avadya Yosef was very happy with Agudas Yisrael, because I'm going to tell you a story right now. It comes from Rav Avadya Yosef himself and is recorded by the grandson. And when you hear the story, I mean, it's amazing that the contempt shown, maybe contempt's the wrong word, because I'll see it's maybe a little more complicated, but the lack of attention from the Ashkenazim to rabbis to the Sfardim. So they wanted to, Agudas Yisrael wanted to put on the Council of Torah Sages a Sephardic sage. They always have to have their token, their tokens. Even in America, Agudas Yisrael, they have their token or two that they put on. So who did they pick? They picked the senior Rosh Yeshiva of the Sfardim, Parat Yosef, none other than Rav Avad Yosef's teacher of Ezra Atiyah. And they invited him to come. He was the first one who was ever put on. The Agudas Yisrael, until then, this was in the mid-1950s, they never ever had a Sephardi. Why should they have a Sephardi? They never took the Sephardim that seriously. They finally decide they have to put a Sephardi in one. Lots of Ashkenazim, of course, but one Sephardi they're going to put in. I guess from the Aguda perspective, it's an Ashkenazi organization, so what do they need Sephardim for? But in any event, they put him in. So, because they wanted the observant Sephardim, they wanted the people like Rav Avadya and Ezra Atiyah to tell the observant Sephardim to vote for the Agudas Yisrael. Rav Avadya Yosef told the following story to his son, Rav Yitzchak Yosef, and it's recorded here in the book. That one time, Rav Ezra Atiyah asked Rav Avadya to come with him to a meeting of the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah, the Council of Torah Sages, where you have all the big rabbis there. And Rav Avadya went with him, and when they came there, they found, Rav Avadya saw, that all of the conversations were in Yiddish. So here you had Ezra Atiyah sitting there, and he couldn't understand one word of what was being said, and they never bothered. It's like that's the way they felt, that they had no reason to talk in Hebrew for him. It says that Rav Avadya turned to Rav Shach. So this would have actually been Rav Ezra Atiyah died in the 1970, but would have been in the 1950s when Rav Shach would not have been on the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah, but he would have gone as one of the he went to meetings and things like that, but he wasn't yet in those early years on the dais or anything like that. And Rav Avadya says to him that here you've invited Rav Ezra Atiyah to come. And therefore, you have to speak in Hebrew, otherwise it's an insult to him. How could you have him here if doesn't understand what you're saying? They didn't, of course. And Rav Avadya was Melamed Zchut. That means he found some way of justifying it, I guess, seeing the good in it. When he said that the fact is that these rabbis didn't really know how to speak Hebrew that well, and it's hard to imagine, but it's true. If you look at some of these videos where these old European rabbis, they never really picked up Hebrew that well. So the story continues that after a little while, Rabbi Ezra Atiyah says to Rav Avadya Yosef, "Okay, let's leave. There's no place for us here. I don't know what they're talking about anyway." And that, I think, is a very interesting story, because it shows you that the so-called Gedolim, not just so-called, the Gedolim, of the Aguda world, the most they would do would extend an olive branch, invite one of the Sfardim in, but to change the way they do things, to speak in Yiddish, they wouldn't do it in their yeshivas either. They never would speak Hebrew. If the students didn't understand Hebrew, then fine. I did just in Yiddish, go somewhere else. But already this shows you that there's going to be a problem with them getting the votes. This would change later, in that when people like Rav Shach would speak, they would be careful to speak publicly when there's going to be a Sephardic contingent, to speak only in Hebrew. And then, they created this Sephardic, the Shas Party. But that's an interesting story. During this period in the 1950s, Rav Avadya, I mean, that he continued making a name for himself, teaching Torah. We'll see the controversy this creates very soon, trying to awaken them, as it were. Because there wasn't much in the way of advanced Torah study among the general Sephardic population. During this period, things were happening in Petah Tikva. If you recall, we had classes on Rabbi Reuven Katz, great rabbi, Rav of Petah Tikva, and he wasn't trying to improve the system of the Beit Din in Petah Tikva. And all he had were Ashkenazic Dayanim. He needed a Sephardic Dayan because Sephardim were living in Petah Tikva, and there's all sorts of questions. Sephardim do things differently, different minhagim, different ways to write the get and marriage and all these things. So it was recommended to him. I think it was Rav Herzog actually who recommended that Rav Avadya Yosef, this great young Torah scholar, Sephardic Torah scholar, is available for a position. And Rabbi Reuven Katz, there's another version, by the way, that he turned to Rav Yehuda Tzadka, who was one of the leaders at Torah Yosef. And he didn't want to leave, so he suggested Rav Avadya. However, Rav Avadya got there, he was picked, and he moves to Petah Tikva. But before doing that, he wasn't sure if he should take the position. So who should he consult with? He actually goes to consult with the Chazon Ish. So we're talking before 53 here, because it's 1951 this happens. We're going back a little. The fact that the Rav Avadya goes to talk to an Ashkenazic authority like the Chazon Ish is, I think, of interest. It shows you that the Chazon Ish's reputation had moved out of just the Ashkenazic world, and by the 1950s, even Torah scholars in the Sephardic world were interested in hearing his position. So he goes to the Chazon Ish, and the Chazon Ish tells him, "Don't take it." He says, "Don't take it because things will work out for you from the standpoint of making a living in Jerusalem, and when you're a Dayan, you don't have much time to learn Torah. You're busy hearing cases, all this. It's very difficult." If you recall from my book on Rabbi Weinberg, Rabbi Chaim Moshe Grozinski advises him not to take the position of Av Beis Din, head of the Beis Din in London, because he said, "You won't have any time. You're constantly busy hearing cases. It's better to be a Rosh Yeshiva or to teach Torah than to be a Dayan." Okay, so Rabbi Avadya asked the Chazon Ish, and the Chazon Ish said no. However, Rav Avadya did what I think you're not supposed to do. He then asked Rav Ezra Atiyah what he thought. I guess he wasn't asking a psak. If you ask a psak from the Chazon Ish, you're obligated to follow him. He just was asking him what he thought. And we don't know exactly what it was, but something about what the Chazon Ish said didn't make sense to Rav Avadya. He didn't accept it. And he went to Rav Ezra Atiyah. What do you think, Rav Ezra Atiyah? And Rav Ezra Atiyah said to Rav Avadya, "Don't listen to the Chazon Ish. Take the position of Dayan." And being that Ezra Atiyah was his teacher, and I guess it made more sense to him because he wanted to take the position, he agreed to take the position, and he goes to Petah Tikva in 1951, and he remains a Dayan there until 1958, with a little break, which I'll describe soon. Who else? So he's serving on this Beis Din, and he's the young Dayan. Who else is serving on this Beis Din? One is, well, it's Reuven Katz, and then you have Rav Yitzchak Meir ben Menachem. And there's a couple other Dayanim as well. Rav Yitzchak Meir ben Menachem was the son-in-law of Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, and he, you can actually categorize him as a Zionist. When they reprinted one of his books in recent years, they took out his Zionistic stuff. They always do that. They take out the introduction because you have these rabbis writing in 1955 and 57, etc. They're writing about how wonderful the state of Israel is, how we waited for thousands of years for this. And but when they reprint it today, it creates problems. So they remove that. A couple blog posts ago, I wrote about something Rav Avadya did when he was on this Beis Din, which I wrote about it in terms of the ends justifying the means, that he thought that a decision should go one way. The problem was that he was outweighed by two other Dayanim, and since he arranged the schedule, he spoke to one of the other Dayanim who happened to agree with him, and he arranged it when the two Dayanim who were supposed to hear the case, one of them was not there, so he put the other Dayan in, and the decision ended up being 2-1, therefore, in his favor. That's an example of stacking the deck, which I always assumed would be inappropriate. But Rav Avadya thought that there was nothing wrong with it. He even mentions this in his response, the Abiya Omer. He doesn't give the exact detail that he stacked the deck, but he just says that in Abiya Omer, he says that you know, that when the court came, when the case was to be heard, it turns out this other Dayan was on the was with him on the docket. But in the book Rabbeinu, which I've quoted a number of times, which is the reports of his student who learned with him with Chavrusa all these years, Rav Avadya says that he arranged it this way and he set it up. So he stacked the deck. I guess that's okay. It's no different than deciding that you want a lenient view and know that a certain rabbi will probably give you the lenient view. So you go ask him that. Doesn't mean he'll definitely give it to you, but the same sort of thing. So Rav Avadya is on the Beis Din. Immediately problems break out among him and the other Dayanim. Because as I said, he's the only Sephardic Dayan. And the issues are over how to write certain words in a get. Certain words are problematic. Because in the get, we don't just write the name, we write in the name of the person and how he's known. So you have vernacular names. So how do you write a name, say, George? I mean, you could write a gimel with a like an apostrophe, or you can write it Dalid Zion, or I mean, there's all sorts of ways how to spell George and other words, how to write these names. Do you put an aleph in the middle? Mark, would you write M R? Would you write Mem Resh Kuf, or would you write Mem Aleph Resh Kuf? Oh, so there's different traditions, and this goes back to the commentaries in the Shulchan Aruch. There's plenty of books tell you how to do it. The thing is that there's various Sephardic names. And there's a tradition in the Sephardic world how to write these names. So Rav Avadya Yosef knows this. Problem was that the Petach Tikva Beis Din was writing it in accord with the pronunciations and the rules of the Ashkenazic authorities. So when Rav Avadya Yosef's on the Beis Din, he says, no, this can't work. You need to adopt the way the Sephardic approach does, says to do it. And the Ashkenazic Dayanim say, no, we're the majority and this is our tradition. And Rav Avadya Yosef replies, it's not a question of your tradition or our tradition deciding. These are Sephardic people, and therefore you're obligated, no matter what the European approach is, you're obligated to decide the question in accordance to the Sephardic approach, no different than if it was a question of the laws of Shabbos, let's say, and there's a big dispute between the Shulchan Aruch and the Rav Moshe Isserles. An Ashkenazic posek has to decide the law in accordance with the Sephardic version. But the Dayanim didn't agree. Rav Avadya Yosef says, therefore, to Reuven Katz that he will refuse now to serve as a Dayan unless they agree to follow his way. And Rav Reuven Katz, to his credit, agreed. He was convinced of the justice of the cause, or he saw that this would just create a mess because this new Dayan, he's going to go on strike. And whatever it was, he agreed to go along with him. And Rav Avadya Yosef was given the authority for all divorces of Sfardim in the city of Petach Tikva. The grandson tells an interesting story that comes from Rav Avadya Yosef himself, as to show you some of the things he had to put up with there, or had to deal with. And from Rav Avadya Yosef's perspective, the whole story is designed to make the Ashkenazic rabbis look bad. But let me tell you the story. He was once discussing with one of these matters with his fellow Dayanim, and he told them certain he proved to them that this is the position. They cited various halachic authorities, and these other Dayanim, they could have been Reuven Katz, Ben Menachem, whoever it was. They looked at him like he's crazy, like, who are these people? They had never heard of these books he's citing. One of Rav Avadya Yosef's great achievements is that books that were not studied for a long time have now become part of the classic library, even for Ashkenazi. I mean, who studied the works of Chaim Palachi, or the Chikrei Lev, or Petach HaDevir, and if these names mean anything to you, and loads of other Sephardic works, which were at one time important volumes, local volumes, though. Rav Avadya Yosef brought them back, as it were, really created them as national works. All the Palachis, not just Reb Chaim Palachi or Yitzhak Palachi, Yafei Lalev, etc. So he threw out some of these books, and of course, how would an Ashkenazic, how would a Litvish posek, He's going to know who Ephraim Palachi is or any of these other works. So you look at Rav Yosef's works, he's citing these great rabbis, but the Ashkenazi never heard of them. So he says, Rav Yosef said that one of the works he mentioned was the work Get Pashut, which the Rishon LeZion, he was the chief rabbi from a couple hundred years ago, the Sephardic chief, Rishon LeZion, Maharam ben Chaviv, said something about how you're supposed to write the Tzeirah. The question is, do you write it with a Yud? So if you have the name Rochelle, do you put it with a Yud between the Shin and the Lamed or not? And he cites the Get Pashut from Maharam ben Chaviv. So one of the other Dayanim gets up and says, what are you giving me this Maharam ben Chaviv? Who's Maharam ben Chaviv? It's a good question. If you never heard of Maharam ben Chaviv, you might think it's some meaningless Acharon. Someone no one that no one's ever heard of, and you're gonna, you have the standard sources, and you're gonna give me an Acharon that from an Ashkenazic doesn't have any meaning. Obviously, his Torah is important, but in terms of Pesach, he doesn't have any significance. In that sense, it's meaningless because he's not part of any tradition, and you can't override tradition by of halachic tradition by citing some book that no one's ever used by some unknown author. And then he says, Uman leimalan demaran ben chaviv bar samchahu. Exactly what I said. You're citing this Maharam ben Chaviv, who we've never heard of. Who's to say he has any authority that you can rely on him? He's a Stam Acharon. So Rav Vadya says to this Dayan, he doesn't tell us who the Dayan is, not to embarrass him, I guess. He says, do you know who the Pnei Yeshua is? Pnei Yeshua, great Yeshua Falk of Rav of Frankfurt, a very important sefer. Those of you who want to come to Germany with me this summer will go to Frankfurt. Tell you all about the Pnei Yeshua and others in yeshivas, the Ashkenazi yeshivas. Pnei Yeshua is one of the most important commentaries in the Talmud in the last few hundred years. In fact, it's one of the unique ones. I don't know if you can say that one of the unique ones. Then it's not unique, but it's one of the few volumes of the Achronim in the last few hundred years that really became standard halachic work. That's not written, and it's not like the Marsha or anything in the back of the Gemaras, but Pnei Yeshua became one of the standard Talmudic commentaries that everyone studies. So he asks him, do you know who the Pnei Yeshua is? So obviously, I mean, is this a joke? Of course I know who the Pnei Yeshua is. Pnei Yeshua, this Dayan says, is one of the greatest of the Achronim. Rav Avadya Yosef then opened up, they have in the library there, in the Beis Din, all the important works. He took out the Pnei Yeshua, and he opened it up to Masachet Ketubot. You can check it. It's in the Kuntres Acharon, where it says as follows: Vayomer Yehoshua, Joshua. That's the Pnei Yehoshua says. Now I'm coming, Ketalmud Hadan lifnei Rabotav, as a student before his teachers. Even though I know how small I am compared to the great Sephardic Achronim, such as the Pri Chodesh and the Get Pashut. That their small finger is bigger than my whole body. So here you have the Pnei Yeshua citing Mara ben Chabib, who predates him. So you're talking a few hundred years ago, and state of all of the two Sephardic authorities he mentions, one is the famous Pri Chodesh, and the other is the Get Pashut, the Mara ben Chabib. So as soon as he said that, obviously there's this other Dayan had nothing to say because. You're clearly not dealing with a meaningless, unimportant, just figure who was pulled out of thin air. And the grandson says then that after that they started having more respect. But Rav Avad Yosef was only in Petach Tikva the first time for around a year, and then he returns to Jerusalem. Simple reason that he couldn't afford to get an apartment in Petach Tikva. They weren't paying him enough. And he also had students in Jerusalem who were urging him to come back. So he's going to return to the Beis Din. But he leaves the Beis Din now and returns to Jerusalem. And it was during this time in Jerusalem that he began to push one of his issues that would be quite controversial. This is the time for when he returns. The first time he returns from Petach Tikva in 52, he starts, he starts giving a lot of shiurim, and he begins to tell his followers that women are not permitted to make a blessing on a positive time-bound commandment, mitzvah taseh she'zman grama, such as luav. in the Ashkenazic world, the practice is that a woman takes the lulav, she makes the blessing. This goes back to medieval times, this dispute, and the Shulchan Aruch rules that a woman does not make a blessing. The problem is that many authorities in the Sephardic world disagreed with the Shulchan Aruch and said that women, and there was a practice throughout the Sephardic world, in many parts of it, that women did make a blessing on it. This is a practice that predated the Shulchan Aruch. And if you look at the introduction to the Shulchan Aruch says, actually, I can't remember now if it's the introduction to Shulchan Aruch or the introduction to the Beis Yosef. The Shulchan Aruch is just an abridgment to the Beis Yosef. It says that if you have practices that you're currently doing that predate us and have, you know, have a tradition, I'm not asking you to change your practice on account of what's in this work, the Shulchan Aruch or the Beit Yosef. Rav Avadya Yosef will become more of a supporter, a fan of the Shulchan Aruch's authority than the Shulchan Aruch himself was. Because as we will see, the Rav Avadya Yosef insists on a loyalty to the laws of the Shulchan Aruch that the Shulchan Aruch himself never insisted on. So he starts going around in his shiurim telling people, why should this be problematic? Other than the fact that the Sephardim do have a tradition, many of them to make the blessing, but even more so, the Ben Ish Chai, who is the most important authority in the Iraqi world. We don't have anyone in the Ashkenazic world who equals the Ben Ish Chai. Even the Mishnah Berurah today doesn't equal the authority that the Ben Ish Chai had. He was the final word. The Ben Ish Chai said that women do make a blessing on things like lulav. So here Rav Avadya Yosef, young scholar, so he is publicly rejecting the viewpoint of the Ben Ish Chai. That is going to be something that the Iraqi community could not handle, would not accept, and an enormous controversy will break out. Next week, we will deal with this controversy, and it almost sunk his career. It had enormous effect, but it almost, I'll tell you the whole story next time, what occurred. And that wasn't the only way he got in trouble, but I already see, I know there's some questions and comments, so let me take, because I don't want, this is an issue, it's going to take more than just 2 minutes, and I don't want to stop in the middle, so let me go back. I know there's a lot of comments and questions, and I'll start answering some of them. Yechezkel Moskowitz says, Rav Yitzchak Chanan Spector's success was due to his ability to elevate himself above all the politics, and he says that the Netziv says this in the introduction to the Shiltos, that, you don't need to be the Rav Yitzchak Chanan. Every successful rabbi knows that, you have to do that. The Ridbaz had a personality that he feuded wherever he was. Now Moshe says that he was involved in many political issues. I'll let you talk about that. Rav Yitzchak Chanan Spector was also able to be friendly with many different sides. I'm unaware, Moshe, of political, much in the way of political machlokas. He had a religious machlokas, but politically, he was he opposed the Maskilim, but it never really became an open dispute because he opposed the extremist Maskilim because they were afraid to go up against him. So they tried to get him to change his position, and they tried to go around him, and they tried to get secular studies forced introduced. But when Rav Yitzchak Chanan came out against these rabbinical seminaries and other things, they didn't listen to him necessarily, but it didn't become an open battle. So much. And you mentioned the Aderis. Yes, well, the Aderis was no fan of Rav Yitzchak Chanan Spector. There aren't many who weren't fans of his, but in the autobiography of the Aderis, which was published, Elio David Rabinowitz Teomim, which was published in an unabridged form by Mossad Hav Kook, has not been reprinted since. You'll see that I have a PDF of it. If anyone's interested, I can send it to you. I don't even know. I'm looking right now. Someone maybe could check. I don't remember what it's called, I don't think. I don't even think in Otsar HaChachma they have reprinted it. This it created a lot of controversy when it came out. I'm looking very quickly here, and I don't see any. Someone could check. I don't see the unabridged autobiography. If someone sees it, you can tell. Oh, actually, no. I'm sorry. It's called Seder Eliyahu. It is here. They do have the unabridged one on Otzer HaChokhmah, so you could see it there. But in this unabridged autobiography, he has some negative things to say about Rabbi Yitzchak Elkanah. But the Aderis also had negative things to say about a lot of people. He wasn't a respecter of people, and he himself was involved in disputes. Okay, you ask a good question, Moshe. Who doesn't know it? You'd have to ask the Dayanim. What can I tell you? I don't know. Did Sfardim have access to Ashkenazi Acharonim? They did. They did have access, and it's quoted in the Sdei Chemetz. Sdei Chemetz is a canonical sefer of the Sfardim, and he quotes the Ashkenazim all the time. So the Sfardim, you look at Rav Chaim Palachi, and you look at the Ben Ish Chai. The Ben Ish Chai, in his response to Rav Pe'alim, cites the Ashkenazic authorities. So the Sfardim always cited the Ashkenazim. It's the Ashkenazim who didn't cite the Sfardim. Yecheskel says, did he offer his reasoning for the rejection of the Psakim of the Ben Ish Chai? We'll get to that next class, but he didn't really have reasoning so much as that they went against the Shulchan Aruch. Anything that goes against the Shulchan Aruch has to be rejected in the land of Israel. Let me see if I'm missing anything here. Let me go on. I have 3 more minutes, I see, so let me give you the other example that created enormous controversy. Rav Avadya Yosef starts telling his students to tell their wives that the way they've been lighting the Shabbos candles, the way that the Ben Ish Chai told them to light, not just the Ben Ish Chai, the Chidah also, namely, you do like the Ashkenazim. You light the candles and then you say the bracha, that is incorrect. That you need to do it like the Shulchan Aruch, although the Shulchan Aruch, it's not 100% clear, but that most people understand it that way. You have to light it first and then light the candles. So here you have Rav Avadya Yosef not just rejecting a psak of the Ben Ish Chai, rejecting it because of his philosophy, which he would develop for the next 50 years, that in the land of Israel, the rulings of the Shulchan Aruch must be accepted because the land of Israel is the land of the Shulchan Aruch. He is regarded as the Mara D'Astra, the ruler. Even though in his own day, he was not regarded that way, like Rav Avadya Yosef regarded him. And therefore, all other psak must be pushed aside in the land of Israel to follow the rulings of the Shulchan Aruch. That would be hard enough to stomach for these Iraqis and these other groups. Here he's saying something about the Shabbos candles. Shabbos candles is something that all women do. They saw the way their mothers, their grandmothers did it. There's this holiness that's enveloped in it. And he's telling them to change. That you're all wrong in what you're doing, you have to adopt something new. As you can imagine, this was going to create problems for him and other ones as well, as we'll get to next class. Yecheskel says, whatever happened to two courts in one city? Rav Avadya Yosef believed that Sephardim who came to the land of Israel were now bound by the Sephardic approach of Rav Yosef Karo. Although it appears in many places that he thinks that Ashkenazim are also bound by that, and they should all become Sfardim, he never actually says that, although he agreed that you could become Sfardi if you wanted to. He assumes that there will remain Ashkenazi communities, otherwise there wouldn't be any reason to discuss Kitnios. He assumes Ashkenazim are obligated in Kitnios, and the way it's been explained by his son in particular is that the Ashkenazim, fine, they came with their own communities, they have their own Batei Din. However, the Sfardim, even though they came with their own communities, and they include the Yemenites in this as well, since they are part of the greater Sephardic world, once they enter the land of Israel, they now are bound by the rulings of the Sfardian chief, Rav Yosef Karo. They, of course, never accepted this. The Moroccans said, we come as a community. And since we come as a community, we keep our old practices, which predate the Shulchan Aruch. And the Shulchan Aruch never requires us. And the Iraqis say that we too come. We're here as a community. And therefore, we don't need to get rid of our practices. But that was not Rav Avadya's position. And we'll get into that more in future classes. He does say, as Yecheskel points out, that you can become a Sfardi. This was a dispute. This is a blog post I had years ago where I asked what my sense was that according to Rav Avadia, anyone who wanted to could become a Sfardi, which means, you take the good and the bad. It means you have to do the Glatt Kosher of Rav Avadia, that you have to do Beis Yosef meat. Yeah, I guess you have to get up to do Slichos early, all these things. So I sent letters, if you recall, to two sons. One was Yitzhak Yosef, the current Rishon LeZion, and the other was Avram Yosef, the Rav of Cholon, who should have been the Rishon LeZion, but he had certain legal issues where he couldn't. And if you remember, Yitzhak Yosef writes back saying, no, Ashkenazi cannot become a Sfardi. They believe that a Baal Tshuva, who was taught by a Sfardim, he could become a Sfardi, a convert could be Sfardi, etc. But a regular Ashkenazi can't become a Sfardi. Rav Avram Yosef writes back and says just the opposite, that yes, Ashkenazi can become a Sfardi. They're not obligated to, but if they want to, they can. Sfardi and everything. Then I pointed out that subsequent to writing these letters, a new volume from Rav Avadi Yosef appeared called Mayan Omer, and Rav Avadi Yosef himself is asked this question, and he concludes, just like Rav Avraham Yosef, that indeed an Ashkenazi in the land of Israel could become a Sfardi, and he even goes further. The question was, the Ashkenazi wanted to become a Sfardi for kitnios, and I guess other things as well, but not to change his version of davening. And Rav Avadia said, it's fine. You don't have to become a complete Sfardi. I don't think he just means just I mean, the case was kitnios, he wants to eat kitnios, but keep his own version of prayer. And Rav Avadia said, it's fine, to eat the kitnios and keep your own version of prayer. I'm assuming, although it's not there, but I'm assuming that when he says you can do kitnios, he means become Sfardi in all the other areas as well, and that the nusach of the davening, because you're used to it, that's the one area you don't do. So we see there was a dispute among the two brothers, and Rav Avadi Yosef came down on one side. As far as I know, he never really decided the other great dispute. That was between Rav Yitzchak Yosef and Rav David Yosef over what bracha you make on Bamba. They both claim to have heard something from their father, and their father gives an approbation for both of their works and never explained the contradiction. What Rav Avadi Yosef's real view is. Maybe his view was different. Maybe he changed his mind. I don't know. Finally, the last point yes, Avram was much less politically correct, but that's not the reason why he couldn't be chief rabbi. Avram Yosef publicly, and it's on tape, came out in support of Tzipi Livni. So, first of all, you're supporting a left winger, number one. Second of all, he's supporting for prime minister a woman. That could also be a problem in his communities. So he is an independent thinker. But the last thing let me just say, Yecheskel says, what about keeping one day of Yom Tov? That's in line with the Shulchan Aruch. Although the Shulchan Aruch doesn't deal with this issue. Shulchan Aruch only deals with if you're in the land of Israel and you go outside of Israel. It doesn't deal with the other way. I guess it wasn't an issue in those times. People never came on vacation. However, there is a question in the responsa of Rav Yosef Karo, and that he says for yeshiva students, and that keep one day. Rav Avadi Yosef's opinion was that yeshiva students keep one day. If you're a yeshiva student, you're going to study in Israel. Come Sukkot time, you keep one day, and that's in line with the Shulchan Aruch and the reason of in his responsa and the justification given that you can maybe meet a girl and you'll get married and stay there. However, for people who don't. And that, incidentally, that applies, you're supported by your parents, doesn't matter. But for people, tourists, I know it's become quite popular today among the modern Orthodox. You go for Pesach, you're there 10 days and come home to keep one day. According to Rav Avadia, no, not at all. According to Rav Avadia, tourists need to keep 2 days from Chutz La'aretz precisely because Rav Yosef Karo, his ruling was only about single men who were coming to the land of Israel. I don't know why this Pesach should drive Ashkenazi Rosh Yeshiva and American Yeshiva bananas. That's the Pesach that Rav Avadi Yosef gave is the Pesach given by Rav Yosef Karo. I mean, that's the Pesach given, and that was given for hundreds of years. Before there were Ashkenazim of any authority in the land of Israel, the Pesach was for the people in the land of Israel to follow this. So I don't know why it should give anyone problems. Okay, everyone, good night, and look forward to seeing you next week.